morning, especially for those of you that may have been in this room from 8:30 on and have returned to hear more about beverages. I'm very happy to be kicking off this symposium with my colleagues from NYU. And for those of you who are here, this is a little bit of a rare look under the hood of the science, hot off the presses or hot off the computer. When I asked to see some of the other presentations last night, I was not getting pushback when I didn't get them. The data weren't quite ready yet. I'm going to talk about development of an observational tool to assess availability, portion size, and marketing of beverages in stores and fast food restaurants, known as NEMS-B. And my disclosure is no personal financial relationships with commercial interests relevant to this presentation. The data here are based on an NIH grant. I think we got the slightly wrong number. It's NIDDK grant. It's okay. It was funded under the time-sensitive obesity policy evaluation mechanism of NIH that some of you may be familiar with. I think it may have been the first one that they funded. And it's a very interesting mechanism because it's a little bit of a risky mechanism because you don't know if the policies are actually going to be implemented. In this case, the grant has started and been completed because of the court actions and the industry basically working to shut down the New York City beverage portion cap policy. Nevertheless, there's a lot to be learned and hopefully things that we can leverage and that can help to grow the field, especially in this whole area of sugary beverages where there's such an opportunity to make a difference, not only in obesity but in other health areas as well. So I'm going to describe NEMS-B and its effectiveness as a measurement tool for beverage environments and talk about the protocol that we developed for assessing the beverage environment. So it probably doesn't really need to be said for most of the people that are in attendance today, but 20 years ago, people would kind of, question when you'd say, oh, environmental causes of obesity, something in the soil, out there. But we know that environments are important among the determinants of nutrition and physical activity. Some of the things that we see, more fast food restaurants in low-income, disadvantaged and minority neighborhoods, fewer supermarkets in poor and African-American neighborhoods, and certain foods less available and or of poor quality in these neighborhoods as well. And we consider policies regarding information about nutrition, portion size, and also the marketing environment to all be part of the food, nutrition, and beverage environment. In 2005, together with my colleagues Jim Salas, Brian Salins, and Larry Frank, we published an article where we tried to kind of depict the bigger picture of nutrition environments, and one of the clusters of environments that we identified included the community and the consumer environment, which at the time, which is now about 10 years ago, was not much of the focus of study or of a lot of action in particular. Things have changed now, but I think it's worth kind of commenting and mentioning these definitions of what we consider the community food environment and the consumer food environment. By the community food environment, we mean the type and location of food outlets and their accessibility. So if you think in terms of the concept of food deserts, we're thinking about, well, where are there supermarkets versus convenience stores, corner stores, et cetera? Where are they located? And that was a big focus a lot of early, why are there more pockets of obesity and diabetes in some poor neighborhoods? Well, it's because they don't have supermarkets. It's because they have, only corner stores to go to. But you can change corner stores faster than you can filled supermarkets, although we're doing that too. So we talked about a second level that we call the consumer nutrition environment, which is what happens when people go into a store, a restaurant, or access vending machines and so forth. What is the availability of the healthful food choices, the pricing, promotion, and placement, and the availability of information? And so we focus a lot in our measure on the idea of the consumer nutrition environment as a layer within the community nutrition environment. How many people here have ever heard of NEM? That's pretty good. You might be thinking of neural electromagnetic stimulation. Actually, when I started getting asked to review articles from engineering journals, I had to like look up why is this happening. It turns out that NEM's acronym has multiple uses. Starting in 2004, about 10 years ago, we developed the NEMS S and NEMS R measures for stores and restaurants. We were developing them for research, and at the time, the Centers for Disease Control was embarking on its first big effort of expecting states to both evaluate and try to do something to improve food environments. So NEMS quickly turned into a tool that could be used for community assessment, advocacy, and intervention. And with the generosity at the time of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, we developed training and dissemination, which helped to make it much more accessible more broadly by both practitioners and researchers. In the original NEM study, we were developing measures of retail and food service outlets, basically stores and restaurants. And the first thing that we were trying to do was to develop the tool, make it based on sound public health community nutrition principles, but also test it for its inter-rater reliability and test-retest reliability. These are observational measures, so people are going out and looking to see what's in the store, what's in the restaurant, and two people may go out and look, and they may not see the same thing. So those are important characteristics. And we also have done and are still continuing to do to this day, examine issues of sampling and generalizability. So, for example, we do a fair bit of work in San Diego. And if you try to observe all the fast food restaurants in San Diego and all the stores in San Diego, you know, the cows will come home long before your grant runs out and you won't really be done. So you have to be able to find a way of sampling. And so that's a whole other methodological challenge we face. NEMS was early on developed to be adopted, and used more widely, and we've been really pleased to see how it has been used in a whole wide range of research and practice. It's being used in the Boston Child Health Study, the Neighborhood Influences on Kids, a study that I'm a part of with Brian Salins and colleagues in San Diego and Seattle, hence the San Diego reference. A lot of dissertations and theses and adaptations to Latino versions and American Indian tribal reservation versions and so forth. And as of late last year, there were over 55 peer-reviewed articles using NEMS. In practice, Wisconsin has kind of pioneered a state-level version of like an NHANES study where they take out a trailer around the state and they sample counties, and they've used NEMS as part of the state study of the health of Wisconsin, which they call SHO. It's been used on Native American reservations in Idaho, in Oklahoma and Colorado, and in to evaluate different interventions in upstate New York and the Heart's Beat Back in New Ulm, Minnesota. So a lot of users. We don't hold it too close. We try to spread it out, but also try to encourage the maintaining of the rigor. And so that's part of the context for talking about introducing NEMS-B today. The idea here is, yes, we created this for a study that we were undertaking, and we have our next study already on the drawing board, but we want it to be something that can be useful to the field in general. We did face-to-face trainings for a couple of years ongoing, training people pretty much throughout the U.S., and then created an online training that is still available that is free of charge. And I kind of stopped counting at the end of 2012, but by that time we had over 800 people who had completed the training, which means there's about 2,000 people who registered for it. Because if you do any kind of online training without a fee, you know a lot more people start than finish. So to get back to the characteristics of the measure and what we're going to look at with an NEMSB measure, we're most interested in validity and reliability of the measure in terms of measurement features. So validity is, does the measure propose what it measure what it proposes to measure, and does it measure true differences in the things that it intends to measure? So will this measure tell you what's a, quote, good or healthier beverage environment or a less toxic marketing environment of beverages, let's say? Will it distinguish that from one that's better off? And are those differences true? And does it correlate with anything? Does it predict intake of beverage calories or intake of sugary beverages in terms of portions and so on? And that's where, by the end of the symposium, we're hoping to get to. Reliability, though, is really a first step, minimal level requirement for an observational measure. And we look at two types of measurement, inter-rater reliability and test-retest reliability. And this is a kind of a basic diagram of how we go about that from a practical standpoint. So we try to kind of maximize our efficiency with the different raters that we have. We're looking at doing rating at two different times, but also with at least two different raters. So that means two raters going into the same store or the same restaurant, not like together, and seeing do they get the same results. That would give you inter-rater reliability. And if they come back a week later, 2 weeks later, we get a look at test-retest reliability. Inter-rater reliability really depends a lot more on human error. The error is introduced by the humans, but also by the protocol. If the protocol is not clear and people don't know what they should be looking at, then inter-rater reliability will slip. But also, if your raters are not well trained, if they are sleepy, as we once encountered with undergraduate students on a weekend training, if they are not attentive and they think, oh, I can just, you know, get this all done, then inter-rater reliability will fluctuate and there'll be a lot of error. As far as test-retest reliability, though, the question is the environment stable? Does the environment change from 1 week to the next? Because if it does, we have a different issue that we need to kind of look at. We may need to have multiple measures within X period of time to get a good handle on that environmental assessment. If that's the case, if the environment is fairly stable, then it may be that, you know, one measure every 6 months will be good for evaluation and for examining whether things change. So, over to NEMSB specifically. There we were in the land of beverages and realizing that although we had worked with kind of a sample of healthy food choices and beverages were always part of the original NEMS measures, that beverages are so much more complicated. And in 2012, the New York City Board of Health announced the portion cap rule, which would have required food service establishments, basically restaurants, and fast food restaurants, to limit beverage containers for SSBs to 16 ounces or less. It did not apply to stores, which also kind of raised the interesting question of, was there going to be a spillover effect? Was there going to be a rebound effect where people are going and buying much bigger drinks at stores because they can't get them in restaurants? How are people going to respond to that, and how are vendors going to respond? So as I said, NEMSB was originally developed to help evaluate the impact on both store and restaurant beverage environments. So we went about developing the tool in several steps. The first was to create a beverage inventory, develop a draft measure, pilot test it, revise it, and put it on an electronic tool so it could be collected on a tablet, data collection using SNAP survey software. In the main measurement study, we went out and collected data to allow us to calculate test retest and inter-rater reliability. And we did this in convenience and corner stores and fast food restaurants in New York City and across the river in New Jersey were the comparison sites. The measures are divided into two main sections, product availability, size, and price. And so, again, the amount, number, and types of beverages are enormous, ranging from fountain beverages in restaurants to blended beverages, coffee, hot beverages, and beverages that can be purchased in bottles, cans, and cartons, both in restaurants and in stores. And then we were also looking at promotional signage, signage related to the portion rule, but also promotional signage that might differentiate the sugary versus the non-sugary beverages, and any kind of pricing promotions. So the inventory was based on restaurant availability. We observed a subset of chains of restaurants, so we didn't try to include every possible kind of fast food restaurant that there was, but we were mainly focusing on Burger King, Wendy's, McDonald's, and Subway, and KFCs. The core categories of beverages that we've decided to focus on were the sugary beverages, low or no calorie beverages, 100% juice, and bottled water, and shakes, smoothies, coffee drinks, and milk. But the kind of continuum range from sugary, fruit juice, to low and no calorie. And fountain beverages varied significantly. This is a very active arena of the, industry diversification that we're seeing, where you can see like brewed iced tea here and whole range beverages. And of course, the bottled and canned beverages were more dominant in the stores, but they exist still in certain of the restaurants as well. Looking at signage and promotions was another one of our foci, and one of the challenges was kind of picking out where there's beverage promotion together with food promotion versus beverage promotion in its own right. So a few of our findings quickly. We rated 132 food outlets. We had a 77.3% completion rate. You might say, well, this isn't like consenting people. You're just observing things. How can you be incomplete? Well, we can be incomplete because some stores and restaurants say, get out of here. We don't want you here. It doesn't happen that much in restaurants because it's a different kind of environment, but sometimes in stores that will be the case. And there were some safety concerns in some of the neighborhoods where the raiders kind of aborted partway through. They were fairly evenly split between restaurants, convenience stores, and supermarkets, and in the two areas. So this is the inter-rater reliability of selected indicators of availability. And again, we focused on this 16-ounce cut point of smaller than 16 ounces or larger than 16 ounces. And I think the big conclusion here is that we have a fairly high rate of inter-rater agreement, and the kappas are good to excellent throughout. So our inter-rater reliability, at least as far as the availability of small versus large portion sizes, was quite good. In terms of test-retest reliability, the agreement was quite high, except for when it came to counting the number of varieties of large, low or no calorie beverages. We was a little bit lower in that case. In terms of marketing, it was much more difficult to get strongly reliable measures. So we had, as far as whether there was any nutrition information or pricing deals. We had pretty high agreement, but the CAPAs turn out to be quite low. And of course, there is a calorie labeling law in New York City and not in New Jersey. So that was an overriding factor. The test retest reliability of the marketing indicators was reasonably good, again, for the presence of signage and nutrition information, but less good for signage for sugary beverages and pricing deals. In terms of validity, you're going to hear from Brian Elba in the third talk about what we found when we compared the NEMS measures with receipt data. And last thing that I want to touch on is our composite score. You can measure like all kinds of things as NEMS-D does, but oftentimes what people want is to have that reduced into some kind of score about availability, size, variety, and marketing. And so this is our first pass at restaurants, looking at restaurants and convenience stores. Basically what we see is not a lot of difference between restaurants and convenience stores, but an average score in the ballpark of 5 plus on a range of minus 7 to 20. So 20 is like a wonderful beverage environment with no marketing, not too many big portion sizes, and a match between sugary and sugar-free beverages. So this is just an introduction to the tool. You're going to hear more descriptive from Courtney and then from Brian. This is a starter tool at the moment, and we're continuing to refine it. We think that, you know, it has an opportunity to be useful not only in looking at the beverage portion cap rule, which isn't happening right now, but also looking at other things like soda taxes, soda pledges, and community activities around reducing sugary beverage availability. And last, I want to acknowledge at least the key people among many who've worked on this project: Brian, Sarah Green, Erica Davis, Courtney, Camilla, and Valerie and Matthew. Thank you.
Right.
That's a good point, and I completely agree with you. We were dealing with fairly small numbers when it came to the numbers of establishments where we had completed either, you know, two successive observations or two simultaneous observations. So there's one of the reasons we show both is the kappa is actually more susceptible to the ranges and the dispersion of the data. But that is a very good point.